WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Nicholas Prophet, the novelist and veteran war correspondent, died last week of kidney cancer at the age of 63. Prophet's first novel, Gardens of Stone, was drawn from his experience in the Army as an honor guard at Arlington National Cemetery. Though Prophet served in Arlington before casualties began coming back from Vietnam, his book tells the story of a sergeant who's frustrated by burying dead soldiers rather than serving in Southeast Asia. It was made into a film by Francis Ford Coppola. After his military service, Prophet went to college and then covered the Vietnam War and the Civil War in Lebanon for Newsweek. He wrote two other novels, Embassy House and East of Eden. Terry spoke to Nicholas Prophet in 1987.
My father was a career Army sergeant, and I went into the Army and spent 3 years in it before I went to college. And I ended up a sergeant, buck sergeant, a low one. But so I've had this fascination with and association with the Army all of my life, and I thought that was a side of things that hadn't been told before. I especially wanted to look at the institution of the Army and get across the idea of the Army as a family and take a look at what the war did to the institution of the Army.
When you found out that Coppola wanted to buy the rights to your book, were you able to find out what it was that attracted him to your book?
I'm not really sure. I haven't really talked with him about it. I think the rituals, it's a book full of rituals, and Coppola's previous work has always had a strong emphasis on rituals. The Godfather movies, for instance. Male bonding between my protagonists, that sort of thing has also interested him. He's a very family-oriented director. He's got a very strong sense of family, I know, both in his personal life and in his vision as a director. And I think the elements of family, of the Army as family, and of these people coming together as family members who aren't really related by blood, appeal to him. I'm guessing for him. I don't really know, but that's what I suspect.
Let's talk about the part of your life that your novel Gardens of Stone and the film Gardens of Stone is based on. It's loosely biographical, autobiographical.
Loosely,
right. So you in 1961 to 64 served in the Old Guard. Now, what is the Old Guard? Most of us have seen it, but I never actually identified it as the Old Guard before.
No, it's those background people you see in shots of the president when his plane lands or at a White House ceremony. They're the guys standing in the background holding flags or standing at attention. It's basically a ceremonial battalion, part of the 3rd Infantry. It's one battalion of the 3rd Infantry. It's stationed at Fort Myer, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac from Washington. And it does many, many different jobs, everything from putting together a color guard in old powdered wigs and colonial uniforms out at Mount Vernon, to guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, to providing escort platoons for the president when he arrives at an airport or takes off from Washington, to greet heads of state that are coming in. But basically their job is to bury people at Arlington Cemetery to render the final military honors. There are firing party teams, and those are the guys that give the 21-gun salutes, and there are casket bearer teams, and their job is just to carry coffins. There's a caisson section which handles the horses that are used in the ceremonies, and then there are just marchers who march along as an armed escort.
Were you glad that while you were in the military, your service was in the Old Guard?
No, I mean I thought it's a very spit and polish outfit. A haircut every other day, shaving 3 times a day, shining shoes all the time, uniforms pressed all the time. You couldn't even wear your shoes inside your barracks. You had to go in stocking feet because you might mess up the floor. You had to be ready for inspection all the time. And that kind of thing I thought was rather Mickey Mouse and didn't appeal to me greatly. I was really out of the service before the Vietnam War really got started. As I say, I got out in 64, and the buildup in Vietnam started in 65. So when I wrote the book, I had to advance the time a bit because I wanted to get the Vietnam thing in. I wanted to use Arlington Cemetery as a metaphor for Vietnam, as a final resting place for our casualties. And if I had been in the old guard doing those kinds of things during the height of the fighting, like the people in the book and in the movie are, I don't really know how I'd have felt about it. It seems kind of silly to be doing that sort of thing when people are dying 10,000 miles away.
In the movie, one of the sergeants says to one of the young men just arriving, "Welcome to show business."
Right.
Because there's so much ceremony and so much emphasis on clothing. And somebody else says that the old guard is the kabuki theater of American arms. Now, was there a lot of sarcastic comments like that when you arrived?
There were, because there are a bunch of there's always sarcastic comments from young soldiers, no matter what they're doing and where they are. There was a lot of toy soldiers talk. But at the same time, I think almost every man in that unit knew that the requirements to be accepted were quite strict. You had to have a certain military bearing. You had to be a certain height. I was very surprised that I was accepted into it simply because I wear glasses. And today, that's not really a hinderment. If you wear glasses and you're assigned to that unit, they issue you contact lenses and pay for it. But at that time, I don't even think contact lenses had been invented yet. But I wore glasses, and as a result, did not get to do any of the high visibility things like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or casket bearers. I was always in an honor platoon, and more often than not, in the back rank where you couldn't see me very well.
You know, one of the things in the story of Gardens of Stone is that the soldiers who are on burial detail all the time, as you were, their attitude towards the people who they're burying changes as they start to realize that it's them. You know, it's people like them. It's people who they know. Did you go through anything like that yourself? And I wonder what it's like to preside over burials of people who are totally anonymous to you. And it's a ritual you perform day after day. It's like theater, really.
You went through the first funeral was a very moving and shattering experience, and terribly poignant. In fact, I think tears came to my eyes the first funeral I pulled. There's the full panoply of ceremony and the rendering of taps and the black stallion with the boots backwards in the stirrups and the rat-tat-tat of the drum. It's very moving. By the time you've done your 100th, tend to become a little irreverent toward the whole process. The old guard, we called burials drop jobs. We called the cemetery itself either the boneyard or the garden. And we were burying 12, 13, 14 people a day. I wasn't around to bury people when the war was going on, although my characters in the book are. I don't know what I would have felt if the people we were burying were our age. Most of the people that I was burying as an 18, 19-year-old in 1961 and 62 were older men. They were colonels and captains and sergeants, men who had done 20 or 30 years and had died from natural causes brought on by the kinds of illnesses that older people are prone to. I don't know what the reaction would have been if the casualties had been 19-year-olds just like myself who had been killed in a war while I was in a very cushy post stateside and these kids were over in Vietnam.
You know, you were describing Gardens of Stone as in a way being about the military as family and the ruptures in that family that were caused by the war. Your father was a career military man, and I imagine there were probably ruptures in your family when you were against the war, especially when you were reporting from Vietnam.
Not really. I avoided all that by
being in Vietnam?
No, but by having my father die on me. He died in 63. I remember it very clearly because I was home for his funeral when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I got called by my unit off of my father's funeral. He had been buried, but I was still helping my mother do some administrative things, and I got called away because they needed every available body to back at Arlington to participate in the state funeral for JFK. They hadn't pulled a state funeral like that for many years, so they were blowing dust off the off the procedure books and panicking, running around panicking. So in a way, I'm almost glad he didn't live to see it. He loved the Army very much. He was a veteran of World War II and of Korea. And I don't think he would have could have taken what the Army went through in Vietnam.
When you were reporting in Vietnam, did you spend a lot of time thanking your lucky stars that you were there as a reporter and not in the military?
Yes, of course. I spent a lot of time out in the field with the troops. And part of my job is actually go looking for trouble. I probably saw as much, if not more, combat than the average GI who was over there. But I never forgot that I had that option to get out, to bug out anytime I wanted to. And I exercised that option a couple of times where I thought that this was a no-survivor situation and caught that last resupply helicopter out. And I felt badly about it, but not badly enough to stay. And one time when I left, there were about 15 people left, and they were all killed. And if I had stayed, I'd have died. And I'd gotten out on the last resupply helicopter.
Did your military training come in handy as a reporter?
Not much. I did not, as a matter of principle, carry a weapon. I was a reporter, not a combatant. I had some trouble with some of the units I went out with. They didn't want to carry me along unless I armed myself, and I just refused. And usually talked them into letting me come along anyway. It helped a little bit. It certainly helped in my reporting. Yes, I knew some basics about strategy and tactics and small unit maneuvers and that sort of thing. So it did help.
What was your position on the war by the time you got there for Newsweek?
The position of my generation in general was that the war was a mistake, that it wasn't working out. I think it was fairly obvious by that time. I went to Vietnam with the idea of being an objective reporter and making my own decisions, but I think I was predisposed to thinking that the war was a colossal mistake, a misadventure for our country. When I left 2 years later, I had not changed my mind at all. I still thought it was a colossal mistake. I think that the way I got to my decision was a little different than before. For instance, I had a great deal of respect for the American fighting man and for the kids that were over there and what they had to go through. Not very much respect for the politicians and some of the higher brass involved.
Terry spoke with Nicholas Prophet in 1987. He died last week at age 63.